We are now going to continue with the symbolic approach, part two. And in the first part of the symbolic approach, we discussed two commandments that are explained well through this symbolic approach. So let's now turn our attention to a different dietary law. This is the law of basar b'chalav. It is a three-part prohibition on having milk and meat together, and it is much more difficult to explain. Just to review the three parts real briefly, eating a milk and meat mixture, cooking a milk and meat mixture, and having hana, or benefit, from a milk and meat mixture are all prohibited. We will mention a variety of explanations, and then we'll look at the symbolic approach. Actually, I had a coworker who asked me a few months ago why Jewish people can't eat milk and meat together, and I was really at a loss of what to say, because the actual reason is a chok. We don't really know the reason. We keep it as a statute. Nevertheless, it's incumbent on us to give the best reasons that we can, so that we could have some ideas of why we are doing things the way that we are. And in the end, I explained that it was a statute, as it is, and I used parts of the symbolic approach to supplement that. So here we go. The laws of basar b'chalav have probably the strongest influence on conduct in the Jewish home over all other dietary laws. We're always asking if an item is milchig, is it fleishig, is it parv. Even though we are subsumed with the laws of milk and meat, and it involves so much of our lives, the greatest commentators have difficulty explaining the reason or reasons behind it. Ibn Ezra says that the reason for this commandment is even hidden from those that are very wise. Rambam gives two reasons. He says, one, it's unhealthy, and two, it's related to certain idolatrous practices. Now, Sefer Achinuch, who follows Rambam's counting of the mitzvos, he says that Rambam's rationales are not compelling. His actual language is v'chol zeh inenu shoveli, which basically means all this has no value to me. This doesn't really quite do it. It's not compelling. So, following true Hirshian approach here, instead of looking at health reasons or outside reasons, we're going to look at the mitzvah itself. We're going to try to study it a little bit to see where does it come from and see if we could build our hashkafa out of the actual halachos that are involved in this mitzvah. So where do we learn the halachos of basar b'chalav from? The Torah tells us three times, lo siva shel gidi b'chalev imo. You shall not cook a kid in its mother's milk. Now, the Torah Shebaal Peh explains to us that each one of these verses refers to a milk and meat prohibition, as we explained. There's a prohibition to cook milk and meat, to eat such a mixture, and have any benefit from such a mixture. And all of these are biblical prohibitions. There are numerous animals that do not fall into this biblical category and are prohibited by rabbinic injunctions. So for example, there are several, but let's just take one. Fowl, as far as the Torah is concerned, is not constrained by these three prohibitions. Our Rabbanim, though, made gzeros to apply these rules to fowl and to other animals as a precaution. The Rabbanim added other measures that we are so familiar with, such as using separate dishes and waiting after eating meat to have a milk product. Now, how much time one waits is ruled by minhag. We have everything from Tosfos telling us you rinse your mouth out and then milk is permitted, all the way to Mar Okva's father, the Gemara, tells us he would wait 24 hours after having meat to have milk again. So perhaps we'll get to this at a later point. Since both milk and meat by themselves are permissible, we could hardly conclude that it's a mixture of the two which is so damaging to the body or to the soul. While I can't speak personally about the soul, when it comes to the body, I have never seen or ever heard of any scientific study that says that it's detrimental to eat a mixture of milk and meat, and clearly billions of people do so. So we need to rule out a physical reason. As far as the idea of forbidden meat introducing animalistic behaviors into man, so this meat is permissible, so we need to count that out as well. Now, topping all this, there is a prohibition just to cook it alone, regardless of if one consumes it or not. So clearly, we need to find a new rationale for the prohibition of milk and meat. So we are going to turn to categories of mixing various species that go against God's order of nature. The Torah tells us in Vayikra, "Behemtecha lo sarbia kilayim, sadecha lo sizra kilayim, uveged kilayim sha'atnez lo ya'ale alecha." We are not allowed to allow our cattle to breed with other species. We cannot plant more than one type of seed on a field at the same time. We are not allowed to wear mixtures of wool and linen. The Torah further states in Devarim, "Lo sacharosh b'shor uvachamor yachdav." We're not even allowed to plow a field with an ox and a donkey pulling the plow together. Now, there are other psukim, but this makes the point. In the parasha of Bereishis, we are reminded many times that Hashem created all of His beings limino, each according to their species, and this is a rule. We are commanded not to interfere with this natural order of limino. Sefer HaChinuch, Rikanti, and others explain that the reason that milk and meat mixtures are prohibited is because it is machish b'maisa voracious. It disturbs the balance of the universe, which was set up limino. Each thing is set up to follow its species. Mixing them together upsets the divine order that the universe was set up with, and if consumed, it spiritually upsets the microcosm of man. I don't know what that means, but that's what it says. While both milk and meat by themselves are harmless, they write that the mixture of the two causes great harm to the balance of the universe. Now, this is obviously a mystical approach to basar b'chalav. Let's look at another reason. The Gemara Nida in Bechorus asserts that mixing milk and meat is prohibited due to the prohibition against consuming blood, as the Gemara makes a connection between blood and milk. Now, I attempted to find out how the body begins the lactation process, and here is hopefully a somewhat accurate, extremely short description. There is a hormone called prolactin, which causes the body to pull proteins, sugar, and fat from the blood supply, and these create milk with the assistance of various glands. Now, I have no idea if the Gemara meant any of this, as the Gemara is dealing with a very specific and somewhat unusual situation. It's not actually talking about the human production of milk at all. It's dealing with the blood of a pregnant animal in a specific situation. But we do see a connection, scientifically, between blood and milk production. Moving on, Rav Hirsch gives a symbolic interpretation of basar b'chalav. He starts with the same concept of limino, as we explained already, that we need to keep all species as God created them. We, the Jewish nation, he writes, have special laws for our men, for our nation, and this is the Torah. Basar b'chalav, Rav Hirsch writes, is a symbolic representation of the spiritual herald of the observance of law in the Jewish home. Those are Rav Hirsch's words. In other words, it teaches us to live according to our limino, according to our laws. In other words, it is the representative in the home that tells us to follow the entire Torah. Concerning the milk and meat mixture in relation to man, Rav Hirsch says as follows. Passivity is expressed by plant life. Plants basically do two things. They use nutrition and generate energy to survive. And all this is basically done, to us at least, to the human eye, in a passive manner. However, when sensuousness and motion are added, now we enter a new domain. This is the animal domain. In higher animals, these four aspects are separated, basically, by the diaphragm. We have the upper part for nutrition and generation. We have the lower part for movement and sensuousness. Now, the latter, motion and sensuousness, serve the former, nutrition and generation. They're clearly more important, and they are the goal of the animal. Milk, a byproduct of an animal, characterizes the vegetable side of the animal.
it is for propagation, while meat underscores the animalistic side of the animal. Together, the meat and milk symbolize the animal. We have the subordination of the sensuous and motion to nutrition and generation. This is all in the animal world. Man, on the other hand, is different, because everything that we said so far applies to man, but we need to add that man has a soul, and his soul makes him morally free. The entire man, together, must be subordinated to his soul and controlled in a moral manner. If man would take meat, which represents the animalistic side, and milk, which represents the plant side, and mix them together, that would symbolically negate man's third and most important side, his morality. This would show that he lacks moral freedom. Here we see that not only can't I consume such a combination, I cannot even make such a mixture, as it represents man lacking his morality and being reduced to the plant and to the animal. So to summarize, according to this symbolic approach, the aim of keeping milk and meat separate is to remind us to guard man's moral freedom. So this concludes part two of the symbolic approach, and next time we will sum up what we said in chapter one. We are now up to our last lecture on chapter one, and Diane Grunfeld's conclusion here is fairly important, and it's very short, so I'd like to read it inside directly. He writes, "We have tried to reflect on the philosophical basis of the Jewish dietary laws and have presented some of the explanations given by Jewish thinkers of various trends of thought, moralists, symbolists, and mystics. But when all is said that human speculation can say on such matters, there remains one final aspect to be stressed. The claim of the dietary laws, as of any other law of the Torah, that our obedience is not based on any speculation of ours or on our ability to understand finally the inner motives of these laws. The ultimate reason for the validity of the dietary laws is the simple fact that God commanded them. Our own speculation, however successful it may appear, can never have the same value as the simple conviction that it is God who, in his infinite wisdom, ordained these laws for our benefit. And speaking educationally, it is this conviction which has first to be created in the child's mind before any theorizing on the motives of the dietary laws or any other law of the Torah begins. Here too, we could apply the words of the psalmist, Kol mitzvosecha emunah. The rock foundation of the laws of the Torah is the conviction of their divine origin." This is very true. When you teach a child, the first thing you teach him is he has to follow. It's the nasa, the vinishma, the understanding, that comes afterwards. Now he quotes from Rafersh here from Chorev, "High above all human speculations stand the Torah, the law of Israel's life, eternal and immutable, like the laws by which the planets move in the sky and the grain of seed grows in the soil. It is the same God who laid down the law which nature follows of necessity, who pronounced the law which Israel is asked to follow of its own free will. And just as the laws of nature are unchangeable, despite any opinion man may hold, so all speculation on the laws of the Torah could only be an enlightenment of our own minds, but never the cause of their validity. For the causa causorum of the laws of nature, as well as of the laws of the Torah, is God. It was this faith of our Jewish mothers of old that stood guardian over the kashrus of the Jewish home and handed down the sacred practices unimpaired to our own generation." This concludes our eighth lecture, and next time we will begin chapter 2, which discusses the Torah's attitude towards food.